In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Does it ever feel like you're a marketing professional just speaking into the void? Well, with LinkedIn ads, you can know you're reaching the right decision makers. You can even target buyers by job title, industry, company, seniority, skills. Wait, did I say job title yet? Get started today and see how you can avoid the void and reach the right buyers with LinkedIn ads. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe, and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Griffin Perry, founder and CEO of Meter.
Early on, we overdid it. Like, we would go, "We are revolutionizing your pricing." And they go, "Okay, why?" And we go, "Oh, and it's going to allow you to ship product faster because you're going to have more pricing agility, and it's going to allow sales to do the deals they need to win deals." And we just weren't talking the same language as them. But we just pulled it back, simplified the story, and now we meet them where they are. We go, "Billing operations is a real pain point for you, isn't it?" And they go, "Yes."
This is Griffin. He's a serial entrepreneur. In 2013, he founded GameSparks, a backend as a service platform for video games, which he then sold to Amazon in 2017. Combining his first-hand experience with the challenges of users-based pricing at GameSparks with the problems that he then encountered at a much larger scale at AWS became the founding idea behind Meter. He founded Meter in October 2020. It's a platform that helps B2B software companies manage complex pricing and automate complex billing calculation. Their mission? To enable B2B software companies to deploy and manage users-based pricing intelligently. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Griffin to my podcast. We explore what it takes to building a successful pricing and billing infrastructure company. Griffin shares his experience to identify and solve real market problems. He talks about the importance of a strong founding thesis and continuous iteration, and why he opted to build for operational complexity enterprise integration from the start. Last but not least, he shares some of his big lessons learned, how he defined his ideal customers, and what not to do when approaching those customers if you want to gain traction. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, Griffin's three success factors in growing his business. Secondly, how he's building trust with his ideal customers from the start. Thirdly, what he's doing differently to give development a head start when it comes to building new products. And lastly, why he hired a data scientist from day one and why you should possibly do the same. Well, hi, Griffin. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me. Lovely to see you.
Yeah, well, that's the same for my end. We got connected on LinkedIn because we were both commenting with passion on a post of Kyle Poyar around pricing, something that I've been owning somewhere in my career, having a love-hate relationship with it. And you actually build a whole business around it. So I was yeah, instantly intrigued. But before we start talking about your business, Mater, what drives you? What do you get energy from beyond pricing?
I'm probably somebody who's quite driven by novelty. I'm curious. I like to find new things, and I like to try new things. And so that is a strong motivator for me. So I had a corporate career before I got into startups about 15 years ago. And one of the problems that I had is I began to find it boring, because as you sort of progress up the corporate ladder, I think your job becomes less interesting, because you learn at a lower rate, and your ability to actually get your hands dirty and do things yourself goes down. So I much prefer startups for that reason. And probably also, I like to do things in the right way, meaning that the journey for me is more important than the destination. That's another motivator. Like I do this stuff because I like doing it every day. I don't do this stuff because I'm mortgaging my present to achieve something in the future. It's like the day today itself has to be its own reward. So yes, I guess I'd say those two things, which are linked.
Very good. Yeah, that's music to my ears to hear that. But I already sort of got that vibe before that. But yeah, that's good. Perfect. Curiosity, trait number four of a remarkable software company. So very good to tick that one off already. So yeah, talking about, you already mentioned the corporate life and then the startup. You founded the business, or co-founded the business, in October 2020, I saw. It's pricing and billing for B2B SaaS companies. That's what I talk about the whole day. And that's what this podcast is really all about. What was the problem that you saw back then that was screaming for a solution?
Our story is a classic one of experiencing the problem firsthand. And so you realize that the problem exists because you had it yourself, yeah. Which gave us a lot of conviction that when we started the company, this problem was real. Yeah, thank goodness that was the case, but we had good instincts around it. So, I mean, the broad story is, because I'm a repeat founder, and it's the same co-founder as the previous business. And we were just chatting before we started, whose name is also Griffin, just to make it complicated. But we started a previous business called GameSparks, which was a cloud infrastructure business. And we deployed usage-based pricing strategies in our go-to-market. And it was one of the reasons that business did well, but we felt a lot of pain associated with it. And at the time, we wouldn't really been able to articulate why, but we knew that there was pain. There was a lot of operational pain around billing, but also a lot of more general go-to-market enablement pain. Like our account managers didn't know anything about the usage or the spend of their customers, so they looked stupid when they were chatting to them and stuff like that. So we experienced it ourselves, and then we sold that business to Amazon, and then worked it at AWS for 3 years. Now, they also deploy usage-based pricing strategies, albeit on a slightly different scale. And what we saw is that they had exactly the same pain points that we'd had in our business. And that's when the gray matter started whirring. It's like, oh, it's not just us, right? There is a problem here. And I'm sure we'll go on to talk about what it is, but like, the boring way of describing what we do is about billing infrastructure, because it is billing infrastructure. Like, it automates bill calculation.
Yeah.
But the power of it is about pricing. It's about giving you command of pricing and enabling your whole go-to-market. So it's actually it's a seemingly boring thing with very powerful effects for a company. And by the way, before we go on, I love the way you describe your interest in pricing as a passion. So it captures that idea of pain, because that's how I feel about it as well. It's like, pricing is exciting and interesting and incredibly impactful, but it's also really painful. It's painful to work out what to do, and then it's painful to roll it out. And so there's pain everywhere. And if you feel that, you're not alone. That's what most people seem to think.
Exactly. Well, I mean, bring back memories. And people that are listening, that work with me at Unit 4 will now start to laugh at me.
Sorry to remind you.
No, that's all fine. Because like I said, it's been a love-hate relationship, because I also feel it's one of the most powerful ingredients in a business that a lot of businesses actually underutilize. There's a lot of latent growth potential just in the pricing part. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the reason for that is, one, it's scary to do. Two, it's difficult to tackle organizationally because there's no clear owner, right? Ownership of pricing is distributed all around the company. And three, operationally, it's difficult to roll out changes.
Yeah.
Because you need to make changes to your quote to cash stack or within your quote to cash stack. So I can see why people don't pull the lever as much as they should. But when they do, I think you probably agree, like it can be incredibly impactful.
Yeah, exactly. And also the various combinations. And I saw that you specialize specifically in users-based pricing. Although I also realized that I found on your website, you do also some of the other models.
Yeah. So I mean, I'd say we do all the models, but the impetus, the pain that is created for our customers is highly associated with the adoption of usage-based. But it's I'm always slightly careful about how to describe this now, because I don't mean they're all doing sort of quite extreme pay-as-you-go taxi meter type pricing. Like a lot of the strategies that our customers are using are sort of in this messy middle where, you know, their pricing has fixed elements like subscriptions, but also variable elements driven by usage, and they're being creative about mixing those two things. But as soon as you do any kind of usage-based, you've got a challenge because you have to capture the product usage data and you've got to apply pricing to it. But yeah, so we support all models, and most of our customers are actually doing mixtures of fixed and variable.
Yeah, makes total sense for all kinds of reasons, but you don't have to kind of make it a pricing masterclass here, but yeah, you're right. And I mean, at the end, I think also this momentum that is now behind users base is pretty much driven, of course, also by but how do you price, for example, AI and what AI does for you, which has never been the case. I mean, I come from the ERP world, which was always the most boring model was the user based model. But yeah, then when, for example, we were selling to government, where they always like to have less people working with more impact, this is where the AI now comes in, and there's a phenomenal model. But how do you then monetize that? And I think usage is a great way of doing it.
I also think you kind of have to. I think there are lots of trends driving sort of the world towards adopting more usage pricing. But the AI one is a great one because it's so topical at the moment. But for me, the real reason that's so influential is you've got companies who have products based on subscriptions or sort of relatively fixed, albeit recurring pricing, but they're stitching AI-driven features into those platforms, and the usage of the AI feature drives variable cost to them. And that's something they didn't have before. So they're going, oh, well, hang on. So we've got these features. We'd really like people to use them, but not too much, because that would really damage the margins coming from that customer. So they very naturally start going, well, what we should do is have some kind of usage allowance.
Yeah.
And then if you exceed that allowance, you've got to upgrade your tier or pay overages or buy on add-on packs. So they're adopting usage-based strategies, but as a cost protection measure. I think that's the really interesting thing about AI.
Exactly, yeah. That brings in the whole point of complication again. So, I mean, I understand, you know, once you get pricing right, I mean, it's, of course, pricing is all about value, and it's a story, like I always say. The opportunity I get, and I also get the part about, okay, it's protecting costs, because now suddenly there's a component of hidden costs in a stack, and if you don't pay attention, it actually drags your whole business down. Going then back from where we are today, like almost October 2024, 4 years ago, you founded the company. You start with, of course, a whole range of options. How do you start building these type of infrastructures, technologies, and so on? So what has been a choice that you made early on that has been very important for where you are right now, success-wise?
Ooh, probably, I could probably throw a few in. I mean, I think we got a strong start, which really helps. I mean, one thing is we brought a lot of people with us who we'd worked with before. And that makes life a lot easier, because there's far less risk around culture and working practices. You sort of have a shared vocabulary or a shared reference. So Just to be clear, it's not all the same gang. We've injected a whole bunch of new blood and integrated really well. But when we first got going, there were quite a few of the team, or the initial team, had worked with each other before at our AWS or at our previous business or some of our previous lives as well. So I think that really helped. I also think that having a very strong thesis is incredibly useful. So it's worth contrasting our second business with our first business. Our first business, we were principally supplying the video games industry. And because we saw an opportunity, but we weren't really of the video games industry. We were in an adjacent media area, and we could see that the problems we'd solved there were also coming through in games. But we didn't really intimately understand our customers or the needs of the customers. Whereas this time around, we really did, because we'd been the customer. And so we had the benefit of a really strong thesis. It's like, this is really what we think is missing. Yep. And then the third thing I'd call out is we were patient before we made our first move. So we did a lot of discovery. We talked to a lot of people. So like, we had our own thesis, but we tried to disprove it. So we were in a privileged position because, we were repeat founders who'd worked at some big companies as well. So it was quite easy for us to get access to people. And we took our time and we spoke to a lot of them and helped validate the thesis and tweak it. Like, it's not like we got it all right. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, when we first started laying down code and building the product, we were in the right ballpark. Like, we didn't get it perfectly right, obviously, but we made a strong start because of that.
Yeah, exactly. I like how you, I can see the three layers. And of course, knowing people is always a good thing. But a strong thesis and then being patient and disprove the idea, I think that's the strong part about it. What did you learn from that exercise of trying to disprove the problem? Because a big mistake that a lot of companies make is, I have this idea, do you like it? Or what do you think of it? And you don't get the right answers. So it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
The reason I'm pausing is that I don't think there's ever been a moment where I've gone, oh, we've got it. Mm-hmm. So I think of it much more as setting a direction, which is broadly in the right direction, and then constantly challenging yourself and iterating and keeping and course correcting. Like, we're still doing it now, even though, we're really gathering momentum and we feel really confident we know what we're doing. But the key thing from that early phase is that we got off to the right start. And then we would carry on. And so I can give you a lot of examples of sort of future challenges that we had. Like, because one of them, you've already called out one of them, is that our original theses were heavily based around usage-based pricing. So, we would say, hey, we're here to solve usage-based pricing. But actually, we began to realize that a lot of our customers wanted to support a variety of models or a combination of models. And so we realized that, we need to be able to support everything from, fixed recurring subscriptions through to usage. But that wasn't part of our starting thesis. That's something that we learned along the way.
Yeah.
Sure. Constant iteration, unfortunately. You can't escape it. That's what being an entrepreneur is about.
Let me make a small interruption here. Griffin just made an excellent remark that underpins the momentum Meter has been able to gain from the start. Having a strong thesis, patience, and a drive to disprove the thesis. It helped them to understand the mission-critical problem to solve, who to solve it for, and from there, inform the fundamental ingredients to their early product strategy. Support a combination of models and not just the new trendy kid on the block, usage-based pricing. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They realize that they cannot please everyone. They master the art of curiosity, focus on the essence, and then build new value possibilities instead of incrementally improving existing problems. That's noticed and fuels momentum. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Has that led to what I always talk about, the defensible differentiation? Has it led to giving you such a strong core that you have an advantage of, let's say, years on others that want to do something like that the same? Because what you say, if you would only have done the usage-based part, I mean, I'm not saying it's simple, but the moment you start adding all the other components and varieties, the complexity increases, and suddenly you need a completely different design almost.
So through luck or judgment, I think we've done okay here. I mean, I think we genuinely do. And there's do have that differentiation. And there's two angles to it. So one was always planned. So like we can take credit for that one. And one was a gut instinct, which turned out to be absolutely right. So I'll take the second one. So, you know, we're basically looking at the world and we go, look, the problem our customers have is they need to automate their bill calculation. The reason it's difficult is they've got usage-based elements. But we also went, we want to target more mature companies that have operational complexity. So I would always say, like, our customers are mid-market enterprise software. We sell to B2B software vendors principally. And so that was always part of what we were solving for. And it was because of our own experience. Like, you know, we'd been this, we worked at this. We're like, we want to solve the problems of bigger companies, not smaller ones. And that set of assumptions has really set us up well, because it really increased the level of difficulty. You know, I mean, we were kicking ourselves early on because we're like, wow, this is really hard, because we've got to deal with like the business specific complexities of established businesses. And we've got to think about how we integrate with entrenched tooling in their quota catch stack, which is not going anywhere. Like, you know, if you're an established company, you've laid down your CRM and you've laid down your ERP and you've built a whole bunch of business processes around it. And there's no way that you're removing them. So, you know, we have to work out how to make them work together. And that's a challenge. So we made those assumptions and that really set us up, because we knew what we needed to be good at. So it's like they've got a CRM, they've got an ERP, they've got this problem. What's the thing that's missing? And the thing that's missing is bulletproof infrastructure for usage data processing, extreme pricing configurability. You need to be able to configure any pricing in the rating tool. Integrations are absolutely paramount, and you need to think about them from the very start. So it's not just about integrating with the systems. It's about automating data flows into and out of them. And it made us think about our engagement model. So, you know, we have to be reassuring to these bigger companies. Like, the whole way we act has to inspire confidence in us.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of cultural stuff. And so there was a bit of luck involved. Like, just because we made that assumption, because it was based on our own experience, I think that helped us build things that are difficult to do and have differentiation. The other thing is the one where I think I can pat myself on the back a little bit more. We can pat ourselves on the back a little bit more. Which is, on day one of our business, we had our chief data science officer on board and in the room with us. And you'll probably go, why? Because you build what's essentially billing infrastructure. And it's because there's the second part of our business coming. So that data infrastructure, or billing infrastructure, collects a bunch of data, which allows you to make pricing recommendations.
Yeah.
What it also does is gives you the return path to action any pricing recommendations you want to make, because that's where pricing is configured. So we've always been building what we call decisioning, but which is these advanced analytics, sort of prescriptive analytics, about which help people experiment with pricing, provide recommendations about pricing, help them with more advanced reporting, and help alert them to moments when they should be proactive. And the whole everything from day one was planning for that. And there's some big architectural decisions you have to make to enable that. And, you know, it could have gone horribly wrong and there could have been no market or interest in those services, but I actually think they're going to be fantastic when we ship them in the next month or two. Yeah. So, yes.
Fascinating. And I hear you, because these decisions are indeed, they just add so much more development time and development capacity to the roadmap, that you're very eager to say, not now. But yes. Once you miss that milestone, it's very hard to put it back in.
So here's another reason why we're so lucky. We founded the company at a brilliant time to raise funding. I mean, it could hardly have been better. I mean, yep. So 2021, the second half of 2020, just crazy go-go times. And it allows us to raise a lot of money, which we needed, because we had such a big surface area and we were building critical infrastructure. And so the demands for the MVP is quite high. Like, if you're building critical infrastructure for a sizable company, it's got to be pretty fully fleshed out. Yeah. And like, had we not found it at that moment, I don't think we would have been able to to build it. I think we would have been starved of funding, and we would have made trade-offs, which meant that we put down certain opportunities and we didn't have to. But again, that's just luck. You know, that's just how life works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's fascinating that you call it, it's a billing infrastructure. And that puts a whole different perspective on the topic, because a lot of people think it's a billing module in something else, like a CRM system. That's way simpler at the end. But this is the magnitude.
I think about it actually as data infrastructure, funnily. So if you think about what it does, it needs to integrate with the sources of truth for product data, product usage data, but also account data and pricing data, like, because those already exist. You need to pull that data in continuously. And then within Meter, you're continuously processing the usage data and continuously rating it, so applying pricing to it. And then you're continuously pushing that information out to wherever it's needed. So that's infrastructure. Like, that's an infrastructure layer. Like, you know, what it's doing is bill calculation, but it isn't really, it's definitely not a billing module. It's probably more than just billing infrastructure. You know, it's data infrastructure focused on bill calculation. But anyway, but I'm, you know, we're getting into the weeds, but to give you an insight.
Maybe it's a category in its own right.
Well, we'll see. That would be nice.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, you build it, you did all your research, you tried to disprove the idea, the thesis. Yeah, started to realize how complicated this really had to be, or how sophisticated it really had to be in order to do the thing it needed to do. Then you go to market. So tell me what, like, your journey towards your first 100 customers. What did you learn from that? Because, I mean, one thing you already highlighted is trust.
Yes. So our approach was secure, however we can, an initial design partner cohort of about five. So it was four, I think the number we had, the internal target was 4 to 6, but about five. To find those customers, then build with them, make sure that what you've built fits their needs, and then push, then try and secure more customers. So that was the broad approach, which is an extension of our discovery work, really, if you think about it.
Yeah.
So we were keen to co-create with good customers. So again, we got lucky because we managed to recruit those early customers. And I mean, it's luck for sure. I mean, you make your own luck because, you know, we'd had a previous business and I think we went about it the right way. And, you know, we comport ourselves in the right way. Like, you know, we seem like sensible people, but you still need to have the opportunity to cross your path and the person to believe in you. So yeah, so that was lucky. That really helped. And then we broadly did what we intended to do. I think we probably made mistakes. I think we probably thought that we had built a genuine MVP earlier than actually we had. So we probably pushed and then went, oh, hang on, we're not finished yet. And so we had a little bit of a false step, and then we probably took a step back and just consolidated, made sure everything was good, and then we pushed again. Now we're confident that, this was a while ago, but now the product is great and delights customers.
So what did you learn from, let's talk about segmentation. Because I mean, if someone thinks, okay, you can bill with it, and other people think, I need a billing infrastructure because this is the heart of my business, there's a world of difference in between. How did you go about finding the customers where this is really mission critical?
Yeah, this was one of the big learnings, because we had to go through the process of realizing to keep it simple and meet the customers where they are.
Uh-huh.
So you're being very generous and you're sort of allowing me to talk about the whole business and why I get excited and its overall impact. But when you're talking to customers, they're often, well, mostly much less patient than that. You know, they're like, why am I talking to you? Why is this relevant to me? And so early on, we overdid it. Like, we would go, we are revolutionizing your pricing. And they go, okay. Why? And we go, oh, and it's going to allow you to ship product faster because you're going to have more pricing agility, and it's going to allow sales to do the deals they need to win deals. And we just weren't talking the same language as them. And so those things are definitely true. They happen. It's one of the reasons why this stuff is so impactful. But we just pulled it back, simplified the story, and now we meet them where they are. We go, billing operations is a real pain point for you, isn't it? And they go, yes. And we make sure that we're talking to the person or the role that particularly feels that pain, who tends to be called a billing operations leader or something similar, or is the engineering support for that person. And they go, yeah, this is a freaking nightmare. Like, we can't do this. Billing takes ages, feels incredibly risky from a compliance angle, is very stressful. And everybody around the business hates us because billing is seen as an obstacle for all the things they want to do. And so we just meet them there and point at their pain, and they go, yes, thank goodness. Someone's, you know, this is like therapy. Yes. And then we can go, okay, we can solve that for you. So that was a real learning, is like, don't tell your story, meet the customer where they are and point to their pain and start from there.
The whole thing of first order benefit versus the fifth order benefit and the revolutionizing part is possibly even beyond it. But it's so B2B SaaS alike.
Yes.
Because that's what we think we do. And possibly it's true. But yeah, let's start. And indeed, we meet customers where they are and actually speak a language that they understand.
And I guess there's another learning for me in there is that I wouldn't distinguish enough between my audiences. So the story you might tell to a potential investor or a current investor is so different from the story you tell to a customer. Because the investor wants to hear why you're going to have wild impact and you're going to be a really consequential business. And so they want to hear about your fifth order impacts, but your customer couldn't give a crap about them.
True.
They only care about the first order one. And so that's all the only story you should tell them.
Yeah, very true. Glad you say that. But still, on the first order benefit and speaking to those customers, and first of all, getting that, yeah, you understand me. Have you found that certain type of B2B SaaS companies for which this is more mission critical than others? Do you, for example, need to have, is there a specific complexity requirement on the product side or volume requirement? Or how did you figure out like where the pain is the biggest?
So I think what might be behind this question is indicators. Like, can I tell whether a company will be a good target for us? Yes, I think there are pretty clear indicators. So, I mean, I'll always talk about revenues. I always say, look, our customers start at $50 million revenues, but it's not really about revenues. Revenues is a proxy for operational maturity.
Yeah.
So we use it as that rough proxy. The nature of their go-to-market motion is a good indicator. So if they've got a sales-led motion in particular, because sales-led motions involve salespeople who want to do custom pricing. So that flexibility to do custom pricing is important. The pricing model. So as soon as you see usage-based elements in it, that's a pretty good indication. And the technographics, so the stack that they're using, is a really good indicator, because like the classic for us is Salesforce on one side and NetSuite on the other. And a company that hasn't got to the point of maturity where they move off whatever they first started using in the finance stack towards a more grown-up ERP like NetSuite is probably too early for us. So we started just looking at the stack. And then, you know, then there's bigger and more grown-up ERPs after that as well, which is great. But it's like, if you start with Salesforce, NetSuite, sales-led motion, usage-based pricing, revenue above a certain level, you're definitely in the ballpark.
Well, I mean, it goes about like, how can you run a very efficient operation sales-wise, because at the end you can sell this to everybody, because everybody that needs to send an invoice running a software business could technically work with you. The question is whether they become a fan. It's likely it's way over the top.
Exactly. I'm exaggerating for effect, but it's like selling a Rolls Royce to somebody who wants a scooter. But John, who's my co-founder, he had a lovely phrase to describe it when we got to a point where we kind of knew exactly who our customers were. But he also said, the reason I know that this is right is the customer also recognizes us and breathes a sigh of relief. And I thought it was such a lovely way of describing it. It's like finding somebody from your hometown. It's like, oh, these guys understand the world as I do. And that's the reason I brought up the stack, is like people go with that realization, look, my problem is I've got to complete and unify my quote to cash stack. Like, if you don't understand that and are asking me to rip bits of it out, then I don't want to talk to you. But we go straight away going, no. Like, we realize that that is fixed in your business. You just need to make them work as required. And they're like, ah.
Exactly. conversations then suddenly go yes and rather than yes but.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Fascinating. Talking about this, this is a broad space, and I know a couple of vendors that are in the billing space. Possibly we've done a couple of billing things ourselves at Unit 4, and it's for sure something with Financial Force at some point in time. What has been your biggest challenge when it comes to differentiation of the company?
I think it's probably less about building it and more about explaining it, mm-hmm. because it's quite easy to claim that you can support a bunch of things, but you only go so deep. And so, like, you know, we're designed to meet the very complex requirements of those bigger companies who have got challenging requirements around usage data processing, challenging requirements about their pricing models and the complexity of their pricing. And it needs to be integrated with their existing stack. And so that's what we were designed for. So it's really, and I don't think we've got there completely yet. I mean, it's making people understand that we are differentiated. It's not a superficial description of, oh yeah, we can do all that. It's like, no, we really can. And so, yeah, I think that's probably the big thing. I mean, we're in a nice position is that we don't have problems generating pipeline. And as soon as you're talking to somebody, then they get it.
Yeah.
But it requires that you get in the conversation.
So what have you learned there? How do you open those conversations?
I think we've learned to be much more outbound oriented. So our go-to-market is basically built around direct sales. Well, there is some partner stuff as well. But on the direct sales, I think we were probably too complacent in the early days. We were like, we've built something amazing. Everybody's just going to come and walk in the front door. And you know, some people did. But we just learned. It's like, okay, well, the good news is we know who would be a good target for us. Let's generate the list. And then let's find a way of initiating a conversation and don't give up. And so, yes, I think that's something that we really learned. Like we have to make it happen. We've got to be proactive and more outbound. I mean, I know there are other businesses that don't have to do that to that extent, but we did.
You know, it's a classic sales-led SaaS business at the end. It's not that people kind of come to your website, put their credit card out, and then they start using it. It's a little bit more complicated than that.
I know, but it sounds amazing if people would do that. I wish they would, but the reality is different, isn't it?
Exactly.
You've got to make it.
Yeah, I mean, I come from that world, so I understand that a little bit. But yeah, you see, of course, all this wisdom, of, for example, on LinkedIn about how to kind of grow exponentially. And I mean, but it's all geared towards product-led growth, no touch. It's good. It's perfect for products that are volume-based, but this is exactly not, it's the opposite.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly.
And that's where, like you say already early in the process, trust is a big issue. And trust comes from, you know, am I speaking to a person that actually gets my problem?
It's so important, isn't it? And like those first impressions and those first conversations, they make all the difference.
Yeah.
Does this person get me?
So since you are a pricing infrastructure platform, how are you going about your own pricing? What decisions did you make? I mean, the reason why I'm asking is I do a lot of things around positioning companies, and you find a core differentiation. And the core differentiation a lot of times is, yeah, we've built something. But you can extend that in so many different ways by adding components to it that make that differentiation just so much stronger that it's almost untouchable. And pricing is an element of that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so we have a lot of experts in-house because we were chatting about it before. Like, we're not a pricing strategy consultant.
No.
But we work in the world of pricing. And we have lots of people on staff who are pricing strategists by training. So we have some good internal resource who have looked at this. You'll be unsurprised to hear that we usage-based pricing is part of our model. But we're selling to, you know, enterprises or mid-market or enterprises. So predictability is quite important. And so, you know, the basics of our pricing is that we have sort of a fixed fee, like a monthly or annual fee, which you can think of as a platform fee, which is influenced by the amount of business or revenue flowing through the infrastructure. And it includes a allowance for usage. Now, the key usage factors for us before we start introducing the decisioning that stuff that I was talking about earlier is basically measurements in and bill calculations out. And so, you know, these fixed price deals, they have allowances. for that. And then if you exceed the allowances, you need to top up, essentially. Yeah. And a lot of the conversations we're now doing about pricing is how exactly we integrate the pricing decisioning features into the product, and probably do the sensible thing and keep it simple to start with, learn how people actually use them, and then take it the next step. But yeah, that's very much of the moment right now.
Yeah. Now you touched upon a completely different area, which is okay. It's interesting to have the pricing on a piece of paper, but then of course it also has to work in the product because things have to be turned on and off. And
yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the problems that we help our customers solve is that, well, you see it all the time. Like, pricing strategists will deliver a recommendation and a slide deck, and it's the right answer. Yeah. But then you're at the start line for actually implementing it, which involves a whole bunch of complicated and risky change.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. Okay, but let's do a different podcast on that at some point in time.
Okay.
Looking at the time, two more questions.
Okay.
Now maybe three more questions. First one, I wrote this book, The Remarkable Effect. So this is about what do those companies that we start talking about and keep talking about do different from the ones that we never talk about. Have you got anything that you steer with as a CEO in a company that you do things that people, that creates the word of mouth, that keeps people coming back for more? What do you steer for?
My instinctive reaction is quite an obvious thing, but it's slightly influenced particularly by our time in Amazon. I mean, you just put the customer first.
Yeah.
And then that kind of relentless curiosity that we talked about before. Because, the reality of business is that making great companies is 95% perspiration and 5% inspiration. Yeah. It's all about grit. It's just keep going. It's like, every day you're going to fail, but you're going to learn something. Keep going. So, customer in the middle, we're basically thinking backwards from the customer and just being relentless. But that doesn't have to be horrible and painful and, shouty. It's a state of mind. It's just like, this is a process, commit to it.
True. Well, I mean, you already highlighted that in the beginning, that you're not in this company for a future exit, for your future pension. Journey has to be there. And what I see, what I do myself and applaud for in the customers that I work with, is they're all measuring their success by the impact that they help their customers create, which is customer centricity at the middle.
Yeah, I love that. And it we remind our team of it as well. Like, we often bring in customers to talk to our team. And I think the benefit of doing that, it's a little bit, you'll make specific learnings, but it's more reminds people about what we're doing this for.
Yeah.
It solves that person's problem. You can give, they've got a name.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. True. So based on the tidbits of wisdom that you learned starting two companies, we talked about the first one, GameSparks, and now of course there's Mater. What would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with aspiring entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs that want to kind of take things to the next level?
I think relationships are incredibly important, and I think you have to work at them. So my recommendation would be, do work at your relationships. I mean, I've worked with John, my co-founder, for 20 years. We've never had a real argument, despite being in some really high stress situations. And it's because I think we operate with each other in the right way. It's like, empathy is really important. See the world from the other person's point of view. Trust is important. Trust that their intentions are positive. Talk to each other constantly. Because it's like a marriage. I mean, relationships fall apart if contempt is introduced. So anyway, so do really work on your relationships as you would with your wife. And I think you should extend that beyond your founders to basically certainly all your early founding group of people, because everybody's in it for the same reason. This is the thrill of making something. Their motivations are similar to yours. So, they're not just doing this for the paycheck if they joined you at the early stages of the business. So treat them like a founder. So that's the do. Don't. Can I make a positive out of a negative?
Sure.
So I'm going to slightly sound like I'm contradicting myself here, because I've talked about grit and persistence and iteration. But the point I want to make is don't believe that it's all about time served. Is that I see a lot of people exhausting themselves. It's like, you know, to be successful in business, a successful founder, I've got to work 100-hour weeks. Anybody who doesn't work that hard is going to fail. So I've got to work that hard. I don't think that's true. There is a positive story, but there is a negative in this as well, because I do think there is a sacrifice, because you have to be obsessed. So even though you might not work 100 hours a week, you do need to be thinking about it in the shower or while you're going for a run at the weekend. And it, you know, it does squish out other things and it does make you quite selfish. And so you can't really avoid that. But the good news is you don't have to work like a slave. You can, you know, as far as time commitment goes, you can create time for other things for sure.
Exactly. I think what I hear between the lines here is make time for reflection, which is, you know, think about things away from the screen, away from the office.
It's when you work things out, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then focus on the essence, which is trait number 7 in my book, because everything is important, but there's only a couple of things that are really important.
Yeah.
And I used to do, I think exactly the same, 80, 90 hours, and I just couldn't figure things out. And my boss always said, you know, if you've got 2 or 3 projects on your desk, it's likely already too much. Skip the rest.
Yeah. Focus on what matters.
Exactly. Yeah. That's true.
And don't worry about what you drop. That's the other thing that I would tell somebody again.
It will come.
You've got this much capacity. Yeah, exactly. Who cares? It's the less important stuff and you can't do anything about it. Forget it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, last question, hopefully you're going to have not too long answer. If there's anything that the B2B SaaS world needs to prepare for when it comes to what's next in pricing, what would it be? What do you see that everybody else is not seeing yet?
I mean, obviously, I talk about this trend towards usage-based will continue. Like, I think, pricing is along a spectrum. I just think more and more of it will be usage-based, although mixed with other bits and pieces. I do think, and obviously this is self-serving, I do think that there is going to be more price optimization coming through. Like, there'll be innovators, hopefully ourselves included, that help automate some of the decisions around pricing. Because, you know, there's this big pricing optimization space that, you know, focus on hotel rooms or airline seats. They're not really focused on the right pricing for recurring relationships like SaaS. But I think it's coming. So, yeah, expect that.
Cool. Thanks for that. So where can people go to find out more about your company, Mater, and or to say hi to you?
You can go to meter.com, so M3TER.com.
Yeah, I call it Mater, but I mean, it's Mater, exactly.
It's Mater. It's like metering. Or come and find me on LinkedIn, so Griffin Parry.
Yeah. Good. Well, thank you very much for sharing all the wisdom. I like your style and what you stand for. I'll keep following you on the next part of the journey. Thanks.
Cool. Thank you. That was a fun conversation.
And this ends my conversation with Griffin. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Griffin Parry, founder and CEO of Mater. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have 2 more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.